Welcome, movie lovers, back for another Anatomy of Movie. Natalie Portman shines in the shimmer. Alex Garland's follow-up to Ex Machina, it's Annihilation. Stay tuned as we dissect it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Ladies and gentlemen, we enter the mind of Jeff Vandermeer. And Alexander Garland. But before we do, allow me to introduce Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans, please don't enter my mind.
You'll... No. It's no good.
Oh, well. We've got lots to discuss today, as we always do. First off, if you're joining us for the very first time, we dissect the movie in a spoiler-filled way. We assume that you've seen the movie. With a movie like this, we're going to kind of make some tie-ins to the book as well, so the book might be a little bit spoiled for you. So if you haven't seen or read both, you know, we recommend that you do so. However, you've been warned, so you can choose not to do it, as a lot of our fans actually do. We talk about the story and, of course, the behind-the-scenes aspects of it. If you're returning, well, welcome back. Good to have you. And as always, you can always get our notes in the description box. There's a link to a PDF. All you have to do is open that up, and it's got all of our lovely, lovely notes that we pull from as we dissect an Anatomy of a Movie. Before we get into all things, as we do, we must start with overall impressions. So, Marissa, what did you think of Annihilation?
Okay, so I went into this film really having no clue what it was about, or like I kind of purposely avoided the premise of it because I just wanted... Watching the trailer looked so cool. Like, it was a very well-made trailer, very well cut in the music. It was intriguing to watch, and, like, love Natalie Portman, so already I was going to be there. You didn't have to really take a lot to convince me. Didn't know the premise. So watching it, I'm like, oh, okay, interesting. And as I kept watching, we'll definitely get into it, more and more women were on screen. I was like, love it, all about it. And then crazy things happen. I'm like, yeah, I like this film. At the end, kind of a mind fuck, but I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Overall, I enjoyed it. I texted someone immediately afterwards. I was like, yeah, this is a really good sci-fi movie.
All right. Dimitri?
Well, before I begin, I just have to do a little quick preface. And what that's going to mean, or what that's going to be, is I'm going to give a definition, Harlan Ellison's definition of what science fiction is. I use Harlan Ellison because he is one of the godfathers of science fiction, with writing over 1,800 science fiction stories in his career, being a contributor to Star Trek and such. Very opinionated man, but he's someone who I revere. He's someone who, from reading him and watching his opinions, he's actually opened up my eyes to appreciate science fiction more. So it's actually rather quite simple. Science fiction is about exploring the human condition in situations outside of our current world. The key words for me there are the human condition. So, in regards to analyzing Annihilation for me, there was a lot to try to unpack, but what I was having a struggle doing was figuring out, is this science fiction or is it just an artsy-fartsy alien invasion movie? Because I was struggling to find, where is the human condition in this movie? What is the human condition about? Like, how is it brought to light in the shimmer, so to speak? And for the life of me, I couldn't find it. I could not find a story that was about the human condition. And we've talked a lot of science fiction movies here, whether it be something like Interstellar or Blade Runner 2049. A lot of science fiction can be very ambiguous, and it leaves a lot to the imagination and leads to great discussion. I found nothing to be ambiguous in this movie, particularly the ending. The ending, for me, it just tells you exactly what happens. And in doing so, for me, it became an artsy-fartsy alien invasion movie. The best I can say is that the movie didn't make me angry, but I didn't love it at all.
Interesting. All right. Well, I like Marissa, saw the trailers. However, unlike Marissa, I saw them. I was like, this is a piece of garbage. That said, when I saw the movie, and within the first couple of minutes, I was like, oh, this is very different from what the trailer presented me. This is way better than what the trailer told me it would be. And so I got into it. I don't think it's a perfect movie. I think there's a lot to discuss. I do agree that the ending is finite in terms of what it is, in terms of what it means. That we can debate all day. And when we do, in fact, get into the ending discussion, there's a... I don't know who said it, but I heard it somewhere, and I can't wait to pull that quote into the discussion. Also, I should mention that we will, of course, towards the end, talk about the Netflix debacle and all that as we get into box office and so forth. So fear not, we will talk about that. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, guess what? You're going to learn.
And but, this movie was even accused of being whitewashing, which I thought was very fascinating, too. But it's interesting because I did like the trailer.
There's two ethnic people in it. How is it whitewashing?
We can get into it, but I did like the trailer. I liked the cast that I saw. I enjoy the director. I was a huge fan of Ex Machina. I knew that this was going to be heady science fiction, you know. But there were mainly again there were many elements too. It was like a artsy version of The Thing or an invasion of the Body Snatchers. There were things about it that I don't know. I can compare it to other. There are other tropes from other movies that I found better. And yeah, we can talk about that. You know, I look forward to talking about the ending. But I did like the trailer. You know, I'm with you that the trailer grabbed me only because literally the talent, whether it was the on-screen talent and the director. I was like, oh, I like this guy. And this looks, you know, right up my alley. I was going to enjoy it. I just wished I enjoyed it more.
So let's start to dig into it. First off, if you love Alexander Garland, definitely check out our Ex Machina discussion. We did cover that. But as far as he's concerned, so Alexander Vandermeer wrote this book, and it turns out it was a trilogy. And he, unlike most trilogies, he released it in pretty quick succession over the course
of...
Jeff Vandermeer. What did I say?
Alex Vandermeer. Ah. We have Alex Garland, Jeff Vandermeer. There you go.
Just wanted to know my mistakes.
Just a clarification.
Yes. Jeff Vandermeer wrote this trilogy, the Southern Research trilogy, and if you've seen the movie, you can understand why it would be called that. And literally released, I'm talking about 4 months apart. So he had it all kind of written out. Now, as far as the movie's concerned, it's A, very loosely based on the first book and only the first book.
Right.
It doesn't take into account the rest of the novels. In fact, Alexander Garland never read the last two.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Garland himself is an author. And so he knows what it takes. But he says something that I find very... And I found this in a Collider interview. And basically, you know, he knows... Going from novelist to screenwriter to director, and he says something that I completely agree with, that novels and films are independent of each other. So working off of the first book, not knowing the rest of the trilogy, yeah, I get it. It's fine, you know. And the changes, and apparently they were vast. Well, I guess when we get into that, but there were a lot of changes. But the whitewashing part doesn't come in actually because of comes in the second book, where we learn a little bit more about our main character, played by Natalie Portman. But that's not until the second book. In the first book, apparently, from what I understand, none of the characters have names.
Allow me to introduce it, right? So I did not finish the entire book, so I can't speak to the entirety of the first novel. But I did get enough into it to understand and be able to at least tell you guys a little something. So number one, it's told through journal entries. And first off, that's a huge departure from the movie, because in that sense, you'd kind of have to keep it to voiceover in a sense. And already there's that big distinction, which I like, the fact that they did it. Number two, in the book itself, yes, you are correct. They are referred to as their purpose, whether a biologist, a surveyist, they wanted a linguist. That didn't happen. And the reason for that is because they want to solely focus on the mission and the purpose of the mission rather than get attached as human beings. Which for a science fiction novel, I kind of understood, okay, yeah, that's kind of cool. And yeah, and at no point I thought, you know, at first reading it, having read, oh, the characters are supposed to be Asian, at no point in the book is there a distinction about that. And I was like, oh, maybe it's later because I didn't read the whole thing. But if it's not there, it's not there. And for me, as Marissa pointed out, the cast is quite diverse.
I think so.
And they've kept them all women, which is great. And so what? I don't understand the
beef. Yeah, it's stupid people. And we've talked about the people who complain about whitewashing, you know, on various other movies like Ghost in the Shell and The Wall or The Great Wall.
Gods of Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of ridiculous. Can I ask a question just to, like, the book itself, because you did say that they came out in such quick succession, which is rare these days. How many pages was it? Is it a novel or a novella?
No. It's about 200, let's say 30 pages each.
Okay.
You know, and...
So he had everything mapped out, if not already written with the publisher, and they just decided to chop it up, I guess, and maybe release it.
Yeah.
And it's very, you know.
So...
But that is rare, because usually a novella, like Stephen King did that, with like, I forget if it was like The Green Mile or... He's done that with some books. John Scalzi has done it with smaller books, and then they get put together. So that's why I was curious to know how many pages.
Yeah, no, each book is self-contained, and well, I can't say self-contained, but contained in the sense of the pages and the length. So, but overall, you know, Alex Garland took to this, and he was awestruck and whatnot. And then it kind of came into existence. You know, Scott Rudin, who very famous producer, was able to help put this together alongside with him, and then we're sort of off to the races. And of course, we'll break it down in more detail than that. But I do want to. There's so much discussion around the story that I just want to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
Where to begin? Why don't we talk about the shimmer? What does the shimmer represent to you? What does it mean? What is it?
I liked it. It looked pretty, but scary enough that you can't trust what's on the other side. And, you know, the trailer did a good job of explaining that, yes. Hey, if you go into the shimmer, bad things happen, or you don't know what's going to happen. I did love the slow progression of what we actually learn what the shimmer actually does, like the prism and how it refracts everything and changes DNA. It takes the same thing but changes it up, and just the look of it and the physicality of it. I think that was very smart and very scientific way that, you know, this film would have in a specific narrative, because it changes what we as an audience know what a prism is and what the purpose does, and how they switch it up in the normal beliefs of and just science and chemistry in that way, I think was pretty smart.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, the shimmer was a dish soap bubble. I think that to nitpick just a part of the creative part of the story, what was really good, and then the flip side of that, what wasn't so good for me is every time we were, like, once they entered the shimmer, we would see light coming from the sky, you know, through the trees and whatnot, and that light had that rainbowish soap dish bubble appearance, right? The translucency of the oily type of the and the various colors. However, when you looked in the sky, it was blue sky. So I don't know whether or not the shimmer was a wall, what the height of this wall was. I don't know. Like, I was, my first interpretation was this was a dome that was expanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being that she was a genetic biologist who studied molecules, I got that whole part. But again, I just go back to John Carpenter's The Thing, where they really make it a point that that what the thing does and how he replicates or it replicates is through glomming onto the molecule would spread apart and become more and more of that person. And this is what was happening here. So what your interpretation of the shimmer, was it a dome? Was it a wall? What, like,
I took it more as a wall of sorts. I didn't consider it a dome, 'cause never were we shown that it was a dome.
Then if it's a wall, how does the light come down and the light is coming down, or is it because the light's being refracted within that area that's expanded?
See, I took it more as a dome, because we saw where the comets or meteor like hit, mm-hmm. and then I believe there was an actual moment where they showed on a map of like only the location of the shimmer, and it was only like a certain spot. I was like, okay, it can't be a wall, because if it was a wall, it'd be like linear borders kind of, instead of a spot where you would think it would cover up something like a dome.
Interesting.
So I take
yeah.
it as that physical aspect of it. We never really saw the top, because that's not where they were getting to. They were getting to a specific location, not the height of it.
No, I understand. But again, like, because I took it as a dome too, but every time pretty much most of the time, if not every time, we're in an exterior shot and they showed the sky was just blue.
Like, well, maybe it goes too high. Who knows how far it reaches.
Well, the sky does reflect other light anyways. There's a reason why the sky is blue. It reflects and refracts different colors.
No, I understand that.
If you're going to throw a shimmer on, it's going to refract more light.
I understand, but it was a clear boundary that they walked through. It was a clear, like, you know, you saw.
Right.
And if this is a dome, that should be consistent with what we're walking through, what membrane it is, what bubble it is that they're going through. And the movie and the cinematography and the director, and I'm sure it was a conscious choice, the light coming through the trees or whatever, there was always that rainbow right here that we have up on screen. There was always that rainbow of color, in a sense, that was shining down through the forest and the gardens and through the water and such. That's what I was just trying to grapple with, what it was. So it's interesting, because somebody else also said a wall. I had the conversation this morning on my drive up, and somebody said, maybe it's a wall.
Well, the interesting part is, in the book, it's completely invisible, which...
So how do they...
I don't...
It's curious. It's completely invisible.
I think that that's one of the things that actually they had to translate for screen.
Absolutely.
Just so we know, hey, we're entering a different type of world.
Sure, I agree. I mean, you have to cinematically represent it in one way, shape, or form, and I think they did a good job. But again, there was just a miniseries based off of the Stephen King novel, The Dome, which a dome covers up.
That was an actual dome.
You know, that was a dome. But I agree with you, Marissa, 100%, that for a cinematic visual experience, you need them to go through something that looks like something that we may not have seen before.
Yeah, and it was also just like a reflection of the things that we saw in it. I mean, yeah, the creatures got mutated, not to jump ahead. But like the flowers and stuff that we saw in it, there's like an element of beauty to it. And yeah. The shimmer, it looked pretty on the outside. Would you want to touch it? No. But it's also with the things inside it. Yeah, it looks pretty, but don't mess with it.
Yeah.
Well, did you guys... As far as the shimmer was concerned, okay, it's a vast unknown, but part of it becomes, is it good or is it evil? And, this kind of gets you into ending territory, but ultimately, is the shimmer good or is it evil? Or is it just a third option, like all things in life, too confusing to tell?
I wouldn't really put a moral thing on it, if it's good or evil. I think it was just... It's a tangible thing, and it's the way you look at it, too, because I believe there is a line that's like it's destroying everything, or is it creating something new? And, I mean, there's a negative and there's a positive aspect of how you look at it. I think it's just, it was a thing not necessarily meant for evil or good.
I mean, it for me, the way that I approached it is that it was changing everything to its own environment, matrices. So whether there was a full-on invasion, again, with the way that I interpret the ending is, okay, it found two compatible bodies in which it could change the DNA, and they're not gonna die from this change. They were able to come outside. Everything that looked to be inside was affected in one way, shape, or form, whether it be plant-based or whether it be animal-based, but it definitely changed the makeup. And we learn about that in the movie. Again, there was no ambiguity about what this refraction was doing to DNA and how it was modifying to suit its needs. And now it found these two people who can step outside and live beyond the shimmer. Now that the shimmer is gone, well, it doesn't need the shimmer anymore because now it has two people who can perhaps reproduce, perhaps cause somebody else's DNA to thrive outside. So that's where I was taking the thing aspect of it, because these people were representations of the real people that we were introduced to at the beginning of the movie and then throughout. Natalie Portman makes an astounding discovery that she took a blood sample and she noticed that she was evolving or she was changing. And the same can be said, and she used that theorem for everybody else as well.
All right. So I think now's a good time to bring in the interpretation that I heard. Now, this either will help you, Dimitri, or it will just solidify that this is artsy-fartsy. So someone's interpretation was and it's someone from Twitter, so I apologize, don't know the name, and it wasn't tweeted at me, so it's not like I can actually look it up. I heard it through another podcast about movies and so forth. But the quote goes essentially that the movie's a representation on depression. Everyone there in the group has had some sort of pain in their life. And that the whole idea, especially with Jennifer Jason Leigh, that she talks about annihilation, and then it's the aha moment of why it's called annihilation. At the end, when Natalie, her doppelganger, it's representative of the most of us prevent ourselves from growing. And so it's the literal representation of you're being in your own way.
It's self-destruction.
Self-destruction.
Yeah.
Well, it's self-destruction in the sense that you're your own worst enemy. And so in order to evolve, you have to get out of your own way sort of thing. And I'm not doing it as justice as it was written, but mm-hmm. that's the sentiment. So does that help, change, or
No, but I've read opinion. That. I've read that in various articles written specifically about this movie, about it is self-destruction, about looking at oneself, about coping. Because each of the other thing that the movie does, too, is it sets up each of these characters have good reason to be depressed.
They have a tragic past.
So they have tragic past, and fairly recent tragic past.
Yeah.
So I found that interesting, but there was no. But again, there were only two people who were able to come out, for lack of better words, alive.
So the rest of them imploded.
Right. Well, like, okay, that's very interesting. How you brought that up. I'm just thinking about it because it seems like everyone else, except for Lena, they had tragic past, but it seemed like they had nothing else to live for. Like, they kind of gave up on life. You could tell there was a moment there, like, we're going in. In their minds, it seemed like a suicide mission for them, and they seemed okay with it. It's not like they wanted to keep going on with their lives.
True.
Lena went in there with an actual purpose, also wanting to come out to hopefully get back to her husband. And like, she didn't seem that far lost compared to everybody else.
But it was noted to your point, it was noted, and the word suicide mission was mentioned at the very least one time that I can recall, if not a couple of times. Okay. You know, the way that I looked at the Jennifer Jason Leigh character is that she had some semblance what's going on, and that perhaps by going in there, maybe there could be a cure. You know, knowing that people didn't come out, knowing that things change, and knowing that she had that similar scientific background. And that too, to me, was the other very fascinating aspect of this movie. Aside from them being all women, they were all biologists.
They were all smart.
You know, well, yeah, but usually, again, in a science fiction movie, you take people like you said. The book had a linguist, right? If you're gonna
no, they did not. They wanted a linguist, but they cut the linguist.
But they cut
the
linguist.
Different fields of study.
There are various fields of study to go into explore this. They were all biologists. They all had their backgrounds, and it was very interesting. Each of their takes on various things. For example. When they find the video of Lena's husband,
Kane,
and he's cutting open that guy's stomach and pulling it aside. Now, for me, an audience member, there was no other interpretation other than there was something inside him living. That's the way I saw it. But yet we had the one soldier, Ferreira, who was like, oh, it's a trick of the light. What are you looking at that's a trick of the light? And so they each had various opinions. She was the negative, like, she was the counter intuitive person, like, oh, well, there's a bear out there. No, there isn't a bear out there. It's just some, and until the bear ate her. So it was just interesting to see how other people were grappling with their loss or their impending loss. You know, if you want to look at it that way. But again, in the end, two people did survive. And now they are either going to propagate that species, or we don't know what they're going
to
do.
This kind of, when you talk about that, there's an unacceptingness to admit what's actually there. And so, as far as Lena and then Cain, they, like, you know, to Marissa's point, she went in there with a purpose, and I think the purpose was to save him. And I think by the end, what she ultimately realizes, and through the lessons of these other people, is that the way to do that, I rather than try to solve something, I must let it consume me. And that's the saving grace of it all. For example, and I think that too. I forget the character's name, but when she becomes like Flower Lady.
Josie.
I think that was another moment of, okay, I'm just going to sort of accept. And rather than, I'm just going to give in, because that's ultimately far better. And it's not a sense of waving the white flag. It's a sense of being at peace.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I thought that was an interesting parallel. At least for me.
And I can't even really call that, like, a death, per se. It was more so because she was becoming something else. I mean, she is still technically living within, amongst the other organisms there. I did like that because I liked her character. I was rooting for her. She was one of the people I was hoping that, like, would make it to the end. Unfortunately, she doesn't. But I liked all the different girls and their personalities. But, yeah, they were all essentially biologists, but they all had different personalities that somehow, and I think that what makes up for their different, you know, fields.
Right.
It was that this is how you distinguish each other, is just by their personalities and their backgrounds. And I'm okay with that, because the answers, and they all contributed, they all had their moments of information that added to what we're all learning as an audience.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there were a cast of characters, and they were, let's just say, a bunch of characters who had nothing to lose by mm-hmm. going in. You know, they each knew.
But they had nothing else to live for.
Well, but earlier
same
you
thing
said,
to me.
You yeah. know, I mean, well, I mean, Lena had, according to what you're saying, she did have something to live for, to try to save her husband, but they had nothing to lose. They had nothing to lose by going in there. They went in with the knowledge, knowing that it's a suicide mission, that there were other missions that had gone in, that had gone on, and nobody came back. So there even seemed to be a mission either that you know prior to Cain going into the Shimmer. So they were a downtrodden group who were chosen. They picked it. They knew what they were getting themselves into, and they knew that there was a very high percentage rate that they're not coming back. So, what do you learn from that?
Are you asking me? Or are you going to tell me?
Like, no, I'm asking. Like, what do you gain from that? I mean, they couldn't transmit. That's the other interesting thing, too. There was no communication, really, from inside and outside. You couldn't do it because the signal was getting bounced back, refracted. So where is this knowledge? Like they had all this knowledge that they were building on, and yet you couldn't tell the outside world, literally, unless you survive what's going on. And even through Lena's interrogation, let's say, you know, it makes me wonder, because at first she was saying she doesn't remember anything, but she seemed to remember quite a lot. and how detailed everything, like, her story was. But I'm not entirely sure, like, that the people in the outside interrogating her were the more wiser by the end of the movie. And then, you know, we know what happens to Kane and Lena.
That I felt was a misstep for the movie. I get that it was a plot device, but it wasn't necessary to retell the story in that way.
Like through flashback or through
description. Yeah, just tell it from start to finish, and it's fine in that way. Because I think it was just a waste of a character, ultimately, and just added a couple more minutes that just, to me, detracted. Not even the fact that it was neutral or benefited. It was detracted altogether.
But Kane?
Not Kane, the interrogation part.
Oh, that part. Well, I mean, I can see that. I think it was one of the scenes that they only set up because it would make more sense at the end, because it would get the audience also questioning, are you really Lena or are you this alien now creature?
Right.
And I think that's it.
And is that alien creature telling the entire truth? Again, she starts off saying, you know, I really don't remember. I forget how that person, now she went missing, and there was a lot of that. Now, talking about the interrogation scene, because I already mentioned that it reminded me of other movies, it reminded me of The Arrival, which to me was a far better. I mean, that's a movie you can dig deep into as well. That's a fantastic science, a great example in science fiction. The same type of pacing as you go along, and you're giving clues as the movie goes on. It has flashbacks. It has an interrogation to it. I mean, right? Yeah, right. And I couldn't help but think of The Arrival at certain points of watching this movie, too, which I think hurt my liking this movie more as well.
I think, you know, to your point, Marissa, I don't think that they had to take out the scene necessarily, but they didn't need to use it in that way. I think they could accomplish it. Like, is she an alien? Is she not? Like, that whole thing could have happened still in the movie, been kept to a 30-40 second scene, and not done it throughout in that way. Because right now, what it's saying is, I am the audience surrogate. I'm going to ask the questions, and the only reason they're being asked is so we can move this forward for the audience rather than just trust them to go on the journey. So as far as missteps, I actually think that was a misstep of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand it. I think it could have been executed in other ways if we took that out, because there were visual cues that would make the audience have their own interpretations if this is the real Lena or not. Because when we saw Kane at the beginning of the film, he takes a sip of the water and there's blood on the cup. And then when we see Lena at the end of the movie, she takes a sip of water and there's no blood. You kind of, like, there are visual cues where you can think, is she really the original one or not?
But not only was there no blood in the cup, I think the glass of water was extremely important in the movie, because what does water do? Water also reflects light. It could make things look differently when you look through a glass of water. The one visual cue that I got, outside of the blood, or not being blood, right? I mean, what was Lena studying throughout the entire movie? She was studying molecules. She was studying cancer molecules and molecules and cells. She was studying, cells. And then there was always 2, 4, 6. They always, like, split up. When she puts that glass down at the end, not only is there no blood, but if you notice the way that the water sort of cascades back into the glass, it's split like a cell at the top of the rim. You know, you could watch how beer hangs on, or how wine is in a glass. It's always a test of how good or how poorly a beer or wine is made. But in this particular scene where her hand was, that water separated, and I think it was a purpose visual cue that something was going on, because there was no blood. The eyes, though, always have it. The eyes give it away. They are windows into the soul.
It symbolized the fact that they've perfected something. Now, granted, whether he was more than her at that point, but they realized how to sort of make this go forward. They tried with him, but he was almost about to die. Now She's fine. That's the way I interpreted it.
Or she's evolved so much that water doesn't affect her.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. He seemed to be sick. Now, again, the opening 10 minutes of this movie were fascinating to me. We learn about her character, her loss, her husband's loss. We learn that it's been pretty much almost exactly to the year. And coping with loss and how to do it. And she's painting her bedroom. That's a step. She's moving. She's beginning to have her head out of the clouds, out of that fog. And while she's doing that, look who shows up. And I was like, whoa. Okay, this is interesting. Are we going into science fiction, like horror kind of thing? Like, what's happening here? That was very interesting.
He comes up the stairs.
Yes. You're like, whoa.
Very creepy.
It was a very, for me, it did grab me. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, this is fascinating. Where are we going with this? Again, the trailers don't set any of that up at all. They only set up that he's already in the hospital and that she doesn't want to go and save him. So I was like, ooh, fascinating. This is interesting stuff. But then it went complete. And then it just went off into the shimmer. But the first 10 minutes grabbed me because of that scene mm-hmm. in her house. You know, in the way, and you could tell that Kane was a little off. He almost seemed like he had PTSD. And I'm like wondering, why the hell did they let him out? And why didn't they just call her to come and pick him up?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me it was far worse than PTSD. I mean, that would, like, PTSD combined with I'm deaf and mute and have no personality anymore. I thought that was a interesting scene as well. Let's talk about their relationship because it obviously the movie hinges on this in a lot of ways, and we do get flashbacks to how she copes with his loss and what she does over the year. So I want to get you guys' thoughts on that. Marissa, you want to kick us off?
I think the relationship was interesting enough. I think there is a point in the relationship I can believe that they were at one point in love.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Did really like each other in that way and love each other in that way. But you can definitely tell there was a disconnect because of his job. He's not allowed to tell her what he's up to, where he's going for how, God knows how long. So you can tell there's frustration and disconnect there where, in a way, it is a doomed relationship, so to speak, because they're never going to fully know about each other's lives in that way. So you knew it wasn't going to end up pretty.
Well, it at least made you understand the infidelity. Mm-hmm. You know, if he was away for so long under covert reasons, right? And he's gone for a very long time. And you can tell that this relationship that she formed, there really did not seem to be any passion in that relationship whatsoever. And I think they made a clear distinction when they were in bed together. I mean, that's a form of sex, but there seemed no passion behind it. And when they were done with the deed and she gets up and she realizes, like, this isn't even fulfilling what I wanted. Like, this is dumb. This is a stupid mistake. And again, it's more into the self-destruction of, do you think that Kane found out? Because that's something else that I read, that Kane was aware that something that she was having an affair, mm-hmm. so to speak. And maybe that's why he left a day early. But the last time that they were together as a couple before he went off, there was some hint of, like, they weren't the happy-go-lucky couple that we had seen in the flashbacks earlier, mm-hmm. of the times that they shared. So do you believe that he knew or had somehow found out or felt it or...
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that he did know because just the way he left, he was even, disconnected from her.
Sort of, right?
It seemed like he's like, I'm leaving. Sorry.
I gotta leave a day early.
Yeah, and like he didn't seem like he felt too bad. He's like, this is just my job. So it seemed like emotionally he was already done. Or hurt enough that he wanted to leave.
Yeah, and I was going back and forth with what you just said and whether or not, like, because he knew what this mission was entailed, or what this mission entailed for him. Obviously, there are other missions preceding him. Obviously, they know that these people aren't never made it back, and he signed up to do this mission, and he knew the all likelihood he wasn't going to be coming back. Why do you choose to go on a mission? Even if you're, okay, your spouse has an extramarital affair, you talk about depression, right, earlier. Is he so depressed that the choice of a suicide mission is better than trying to reconcile?
I mean, it could be. It could be. Especially, I mean, part of it, you know, what you don't even have to necessarily call it a suicide mission, but adrenaline junkies, right? It's kind of almost like the same thing where you just have to fill your cup of tea to feel alive. And so in that sense, with as far as the relationship, if he doesn't feel alive, a sense of any pride and so forth, whether he calls it a suicide mission or not, it's certainly thrilling.
But that's what the main premise and feeling and thought behind the Hurt Locker is about, mm-hmm. what you just said. I only use the word suicide mission because the movie and characters use the word. I'm not like a, you know, I'm not.
But I just wanted to offer a counterpoint to that, and as to why, and like him in particular. I wanted to offer that counterpoint of, a different side of it to suicide mission is adrenaline junkie.
Sure.
You know, it's not to say like when you jump out of a plane that it's a suicide mission, but, you know, granted, when you sign up for that thing, it literally says, you might die, sign here. Yeah. Pretty much verbatim.
It's one of the reasons why I don't do that. Because my luck.
I mean, I can see where you say that also, but we didn't see that much of Kane for the audience to think that he is an adrenaline junkie. This is stuff that he's always doing. Like, it seemed like, yeah, he was going on a mission, but that was just because of his work. Not because, hey, I have to do this because I love the thrill.
Yeah, and again, I'll reiterate too, the movie did make a point to show them together as a couple, happy mm-hmm. as a couple together. So, yeah, it was just, it's interesting. And now we also learned from the movie why that doppelganger of Kane goes back to Lena. Because the real self said, go find Lena. Mm-hmm. You know? And again, to me, that goes, sort of falls more under the category of the thing or alien invasion, because I was compatible with her. At least at one time, I was compatible.
But that you might she was be my life.
Yeah, and you, if you're me, if I'm you, you're me, you should seek her out.
Uh-huh. Second chance, in a way.
You know, interest, you know. If this is what your goal is.
Okay.
So, I what do I know?
Well, let's...
it's all refractions and...
I know you guys haven't read the books, but let me pose you guys questions that bring up the differences between the two, and I'm bringing them up more so from a thematic standpoint, because it's interesting. I don't necessarily mind when a movie is different than the book, but like Jurassic Park, for example, vastly different movie to book, but the spirit and tone of it kind of different. It is the same. Whereas here, I want to get you guys' perspective, and hopefully my reading of it doesn't skew you one way or the other, and you guys can come to your own conclusion. Okay. But one of the big things is, in the book, Area X, the biologist, which is Natalie Portman, she discovers a tunnel. Now, she calls it a tower, and it continues to be like this thing, like, I think it's a tower, even though it's underground. Anyway, she's drawn to this place, and she goes down deep into it, and there's letters written there, but they're live letters. It's essentially plants. And the reason she changes and gets her heightened sense of anything is because it shoots her in the face. And that's how she starts changing. So until that happens, everything's you remain the same. You're just kind of like a visitor to the zoo, essentially, right? The movie makes it very different because by entering, you become contaminated right off the bat. And so I want to get you guys' perspective, A, about that change, and B, how that maybe affects your reading of the movie.
So I'd imagine that'd be the equivalent of her going into that tunnel at the end in the lighthouse, and she's gazing into that big spherical orby glow thingy. I don't even know what you call it. It was pretty to look at.
It worked.
It didn't really like attack her, so to speak, or you know, spit things in her face to change her DNA. It was like afterwards. It took her blood. That was it.
But don't forget, her DNA was already changing.
Yeah.
But it
only needed her blood to get that simple drop of blood, enough DNA to create a whole nother self.
Right, and to see compatibility, I think. Because I think a lot of it is, what is this compatible with? Like, how can we restructure this so that it regenerates the way the alien potentially is. Now, it's interesting because the way you described that story is that she sees the floor and it shoots her in the face. Like, you just took a plot line out of the original Star Trek series where Spock gets shot with spores and it changes him.
Well, I didn't, but Jeff Vandermeer did.
Right. You just described it.
Okay.
So,
in the book, does it duplicate as well, or does it just change the original host?
Ooh, that's a question you're asking me. I should have read the whole book if you want me to answer that.
I mean, that could be a major plot point, because if the plant in the book is what changes the original host of Lena, then essentially we only have one person at the end of the book compared to a duplicate of Lena in the movie.
Right, but I think another thing that's important that we can add to this character, because we were just talking about this, is that her husband, or Kane, dies, like in the book version. He dies. So that takes away this whole relationship thing that we were just talking about. From a movie standpoint, I find it more interesting that he doesn't quote unquote die. Mm-hmm. It is in a sense a rescue mission. So, and if there is a change to take place, if there is an evolution to happen because of these spores or this refraction of DNA, that to me, it makes it more of a cinematic cohesiveness. And there's a goal. There's a goal where, I guess in the book, the goal is to find out what killed him. And how is it going to affect other people? I mean, I haven't read the book, but I am just going on.
But in a nutshell, the way it's described is that the book is far more hopeful than what the movie ends up being, which, of course, you kind of have to be. You have two other books to continue this on with, whereas Alex Garland has stated this is one and done. He is not interested in a sequel, let alone a third movie in this Annihilation trilogy for Garland.
Right.
Or would be.
Well, so, essentially for the film, there like it did have a beginning, middle, and end in itself. It wrapped it up. Sure. So,
well, and again, I don't mind. Like, okay, it does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. We can theorize what happens after the end, you know. Mm-hmm. But just going back, using Carpenter's The Thing, that movie ends on a far more morose note, and it ends with two people in this campsite, and are they transformed? Are they transfigured? Is one of them transfigured? We're never gonna know that ending. But in this ending, we know that they've transformed and they're gonna go on and perhaps we don't know what their ultimate goal is. But I would have to say, since they spent so much time saying it changes everything to their nature, that now that they have two living beings on the planet Earth, that, I don't know.
It's a great way to describe the book and the movie. Yeah. Now we have two entities living.
Right. Is it Live or Memorex?
All right. Any other story stuff that you guys want to touch upon before we get into more of the behind-the-scenes stuff?
I like the creatures. I mean, it's not, kind of adds to the story, but just how the creatures were also mutated. Because, yeah, we changed the physical and the physiological, more so, DNA of the humans, but also how it affected the creatures, like the bear. What?
The bear.
It was a mutated bear, but it just like that. I think that also just adds to the narrative of like all the plants, all the bears, and all the people. Everything changes within the Shimmer.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Sharkadile, which seemed to come right out of a sci-fi D-movie type of a plot, Sci-Fi Channel kind of thing.
Is that also in the book?
I call it the Mockingjay Bear, because that's what it is. It's imitating, the sound. Very done to incredible great effect and creepiness. And again, it just led to America Ferrera, right? I forget what her character's name. No, who was that?
Gina Rodriguez.
My apologies.
Don't get the Latinos messed up.
No, but she like again, she was the one that didn't believe this bear, and she ties everybody, all the rest of the surviving members up, thinking that they're crazy. Mm-hmm. And that was an intense scene because we're actually seeing her going into dementia.
Yeah, you kind of...
Right?
Yeah, sorry not to cut you. No. But the girls, you did kind of see a slow devolving aspect of all of them. They were deteriorating. But I think Anya, who was, Gina Rodriguez, she was the most likable out of all of them.
Did you think so?
Yeah.
Oh, at the beginning. At the beginning, yes.
At the beginning. Agreed. And literally, I had this conscious thought. I was like, oh, shit, something's going to happen to her. And she ultimately becomes the most dislikable person.
Right.
She changed the most in this film. And I think it was a really cool aspect of... Yeah, we're in this time where, Me Too movement, women power, time's up. And I love it. It's a good movement moving forward in history. But also just when women are pitted against each other. It's not pretty.
Yeah, no. And again, I take this to, this is right out. This is Heart of Darkness. This is like the journey in which you can either lose your sanity and trying to find that objective, which would, Kurt. The lighthouse is Kurt. In this, right? So we've got, it's Heart of Darkness, Apocalypse Now. It's taking this journey down unfamiliar territory and how this could lead to madness. And that character went mad.
She went south and real quick.
She went south, and I was actually afraid of our other characters because they were still trying to cope with what the hell may be happening to them. And now she's got them tied and gagged. And the Mockingjay Bear is outside. To me, when the Mockingjay Bear took her, I was like, yay. I'm like, that'll learn you. They weren't lying about this. But there was such a creepy... The design of the bear, the sounds that the bear made, it was done to very, very great effect, I felt,
Yeah, I mean, they got... As far as... The visual, they got a lot of things amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the creatures, whether it is the shimmer of the wall / dome, whatever you want to call it. And even the doppelganger, like that, the fact that we linger on that scene for so long, if that visually doesn't work.
Oh, you're laughing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a testament to the, maybe initially isolated as a, let's say as a short film, you could laugh at that, but in the context of everything, the movie made it work.
Right.
And I remember people just walking out, and I don't think they were like angry or whatever. They were literally just pondering part of it was a sense of, was this good? Was it bad? But they were just, as Marissa said, mind fucks. So they're like, all right, I got to process this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it is a testament because if the visuals did not work, then people wouldn't have that feeling.
Right, and I think a lot of credit should be given to Mark Digby, production designer on the film, who is, trying to come up with this stuff because, it was very interesting. And I'll get back to the bear in a second, but... He's quoted as saying, it's really hard to make a representation of a human and plant without thinking Edward Scissorhands. And I got to be honest with you, that's one of the first things. I go, oh, it's a topiary. What do they have topiaries here for? Like, what's going on? So he's right. It is hard to not think of
see,
that.
See, I didn't think of that until just now.
There you go. Now you're not going to be able to get it out of your
now
head.
Now you ruined it for me. Thank
sorry.
You.
I'm so sorry. But listen, they had a challenge to do because how do you again, talking about the bear, you know, he was, ooh. It was, he said that this thing, this, the he goes, he had to make it as sad as it was scary. The sad part being that the starting point was, this is a damaged creature. This is a creature that's not quite taking to the DNA refractals or refracturing it within itself, but it's gotten this ability to mimic the sound of its victims. Ooh. So whether it be a human or some other idea, maybe whatever it was, but if you noticed its face looked as if it were like just cancerous ridden. It was in decay. So it didn't seem like being that bear was all that great of a cup of tea. It looked like it was painful and maybe it was attacking because of this thing. But again, the sounds that we used and the sound design made the scene, and the way that it was shot and it was dark, it was in a way it really wasn't using sense of smell. Like, it seemed to be more keyed hearing. In on right noise.
Yeah.
So I found it to be very. It was a very fascinating thing, and it had been. And again, just going by what Mark Digby says, you know. It had been destroyed and changed also. So it was a starting point for what was a damaged creature. We wanted to be powerful as well as threatening. And it was certainly threatening. Even before that room scene, when it takes that other biologist, its first victim, and it, because they're looking for it. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, it tore a hole through the fence like a zipper. And the first time we see it was pretty intense as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so. The cool thing about the bear is that they actually did build a real size bear head for, yeah. And they actually puppeteered it on set. They created the design via visual effects, but then, you know, in the concept art and all that, but they did actually build a practical bear skull to move around.
Yeah.
So you had your real-time reaction there.
Absolutely. And the shimmer itself, too, which I find interesting, you know, had some, was inspired, too, in part by the Aurora Borealis. I didn't find anything. To me, it looked like dish soap. It softens your hands. While you're hunting bear. So
maybe that was it.
Like the palm olive dish soap.
The palm olive. You know, there was a very conscious decision to make. I mean, even the plants. Like you said this earlier, too. All that had, whatever was the gardening, the flowers, the plants themselves, had a vibrancy to them. Which, again, makes this, like, is this bad? Is this good? But wherever the plants were, there was that ugly hole. Mm-hmm. Like, remember when they got to the second camp?
Mm-hmm.
And that guy was there, and there was that big hole, and everything seemed to be emanating from that. But there were still some very vibrant colored flowers or whatever you want to call them.
We did learn something very important from the plants, is that they had the Hox gene, or the Hox genetic makeup of the actual physical form of
yes.
humans.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's important. And then 30 minutes later, we actually got the alien with the actual form of the human form. I'm like, yep, there it
right.
is.
Yeah.
So as cool as the plants were, they did serve a purpose too, that they can replicate the human form.
Which, by the way, a lot of the science stuff, ironically, is somewhat verifiable. If you Google, and I've included a couple of things in the rundown, but if you Google scientific accuracy of annihilation, a crap ton of articles will come up, and you
yeah.
can just dig through it, and it's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
I like that.
So if you like science, dig in.
Yeah, there's I Googled Annihilation Production, and there's actually a book called Annihilation Production. And I was like, damn it! I have to rework that. Go, now, who knew? But yes, there is a bunch that you can come up with. And again, with the way that the cells replicate, and you know, there seemed to be some science fact blended in with this fiction.
Yeah. This is kind of slightly back to story, but I do want to bring it up. I think the biggest difference between Arrival and Annihilation is that as far as the government is concerned in both, Arrival does a much better job of introducing kind of their role in the alien invasion versus this one just seems very hyper-real. So I thought that was an interesting difference between the two.
And I think Arrival did a good job of explaining that these aliens aren't there to do harm. You know, they were just there. They didn't have a nefarious purpose, where this one, they clearly set up the idea. If you go into the Shimmer, everything dies. People kill each other. Nothing comes out. You know, so there was already like a negative connotation with death to this race compared to Arrival.
And I still believe too that the military in Annihilation, I still believe that they're uninformed, like as to what truly is happened or happening. So they weren't as informed, I think, as those who were in the Arrival, and the team going into the Arrival too is again more the type of team that one might be accustomed to watching a science fiction type thing. I just don't think that the military or the scientists in Annihilation were any more the wiser once they got to the end of that story that Lena had.
Yeah. Had well, let's you know, this doesn't necessarily answer it 100%, but there's a whole sequence that was cut out in editing, 10 minutes.
Right.
And it pretty much was Jennifer Jason Leigh's character and Natalie Portman. And just like that 10 minutes, they were able to take out. Let me read a couple of quotes. The deleted scene in question occurs during the first meeting between Natalie Portman's Lena and Jennifer Jason Leigh's Dr. Ventress. In the theatrical cut, Ventress' team abducts Lena after her husband falls ill. Lena wakes up in a holding room and is introduced to Ventress. The original moment, however, found Lena waking up and before meeting Ventress, finding a way to escape the room. She knocks out a guard, steals his gun, and leaves the facility, only to realize she's in a remote area with nowhere to run. Explaining it, Garland says, it's this weird thing that happens in a script to seeing it, that things make sense sometimes when you're reading it, but when you watch it, it immediately stops making sense. Essentially, what makes it in the sequence is that Natalie Portman, quite early in the film, is locked in a sort of chamber where she first meets Dr. Ventress, and then she leaves. Natalie's character, Lena, is stuck there, and she escapes, and that chamber knocks out a guard, blah, blah, blah. And essentially, she runs out. But through that escape, she's supposed to run out and see the Shimmer for herself, which is a form of containment. You can either choose to go in the Shimmer, or you can choose to... both are essentially become a form of entrapment.
Sure.
Interesting.
In a sense.
I mean, like, I think theatrically it made more sense to just have a more civil conversation of, yeah, I abducted you, but let's talk first, compared to Lena running and then finding out all for herself and then probably being heated, having a heated conversation with Ventress. So.
Yeah, and I think breaking that deleted scene down, too, I think it becomes a question of, okay, what do we want here? What do we want to do? Do we want the discovery of the Shimmer to be in shock? Because, like, you know that scene leads to her going outside, seeing that, and she's just stopped. And then Ventress most likely comes up from behind her and says, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like, why would you want to decide to go in it later if you're already afraid of it?
Well, as a scientist, it could be something of awe, and then, like, all the pieces of the puzzle come together. This is what Kane was going into. Or for the sake of this movie, is it better to have the dialogue? Because they still both end up on that balcony. Look, you know, this is the mission. So I think from the cinematic standpoint, from the way that this movie is paced, the way that Garland and company chose to go by taking out that deleted scene, I think it was for the act of telling the story, I think it was the better choice.
Yeah, and you want to get to the shimmer faster. That's where the story is. That's where all this is leading to. Mm-hmm. And so the faster you get there, the better the movie becomes,
right,
in my opinion. Let's talk about the music, because if there's... Hopefully you guys agree, but I love the music.
It was very... Yeah. Haunting is a good word, particularly sure. The synthesizers and the synthesizers used to make the three or four notes of what depicted the alien,
mm-hmm.
Especially in the lighthouse scene when she's fighting herself.
As they say, it's four simple notes. So here's kind of... the two composers are Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury, who have collaborated often, whether Free Fire, Ex Machina. I believe Jeff Barrow only, he did Fantastic Four. I don't know if Ben collaborated with him on that, but Salisbury says of that, "You are hearing synths. As I said, it's the only time in the score that synths and electronics make an overt appearance. They do so purposefully in this part of the film so that it stands apart. It would have been done on... with various secret ingredients put in, but it's essentially as simple as it can be. It's four notes. Sometimes the most arresting things are the simplest things." So,
I can believe that. I mean, if you want to take it to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you had John Williams and his five notes of the synths. So, I mean, I think simplicity really does work, especially for aliens. Why not?
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's funny that you brought that up, because that's exactly when I read that same article and we talked about it, because Spielberg wanted, like, I want like three or four notes, and he's like, "You really can't do that. That's not a song. Like, five notes make up a song. Anything less than that,
four notes could make up a bar.
Right? It could be disorientating, which it was here. So obviously, John Williams is onto something, and this person took that same exactly, and by using the four and using the synths to that sound. And again, we can talk about this once we start going into Netflix territory, but hearing it in a theater that's equipped with really good sound, I mean, those notes, that sound was very uncomfortable.
Yeah,
Done to effect. It was, and that's where synthesizer was done to. Score was done to effect.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then the scene that I definitely noticed it, because it was all just music, was when she actually lights the alien on fire, and the whole lighthouse just goes up in flames. Because there's no dialogue during it. It's just literally a crescendo of music as the place is burning up in flames. I think it was very well done. Very creepy at the same time.
And it was used in the trailer well, which they didn't know that they were going to pop that into the trailer. But again, I think I did find there was effectiveness to the trailer. I thought as a marketing tool, even though it's kind of a bait and switch. Well, it got me interested. I don't know how else you market that movie after watching that movie.
But the trailer music was so well done, too.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't find the trailer misleading in the sense it just initially it felt like more of a boring movie than it actually ended up being.
Interesting.
So, anywho, all right. Well, why don't we get into the Netflix territory? First off, so overall, right now, 87% on Rotten Tomatoes out of 174 reviews. With a U.S. cinema score of C, which isn't necessarily great. And the reason I say that is because one of the producers of the movie really didn't feel like people would understand this movie. Through test screenings, people were highly confused and so forth. However, he did not have final cut. Scott Rudin did, and he believed in the project as it was. which led to them being like, okay, we're going to distribute it. However, the international rights were selling off and mm-hmm. Netflix buys it.
Yeah, and I think, too, it was, if I read it correctly, it was a battle of two producers. It was Scott Rudin and his name, David Ellison.
David Ellison,
Megan's brother. Skydance, because Skydance produced it. And there was a big battle as to how this was going to be done and how this was going to be perceived. So look, it's a hard sell. If we're going to get into this, this whole Netflix deal, I talked about it at some length when I did meet the movie press a few weeks ago, because the movie Cloverfield Paradox, which made the big splash in the Super Bowl, and that was sold from Paramount. That was sold by Paramount to Netflix to escape the theatrical route. And I use the words escape and route purposely, because had that movie gone through distribution ends, it was going to get routed by the critics for sure, and they probably would not have made much of their money back, where Netflix paid $50 million up front to get that movie on there. I'm not sure what Netflix may have paid for Annihilation.
I haven't seen the figures.
Alex Garland. I am disappointed in Alex Garland's feeling and thoughts about this, because he's basically giving in. This movie was shot to be on the big screen, and if that's what you're making it for...
Wait, you saw evidence that he gave into it?
Well, he's got no problem with
I have a whole different quote.
Yeah, was actually very upset that it was on...
Here's the quote I have.
Okay.
And then you tell me where yours comes from and how it's different. A week after, he said, "We made the film for cinema. I've got no problem with the small screen at all. It was taken out of context, in which we could talk about. The best genre piece I've seen in a long time was The Handmaid's Tale. So I think there's incredible potential within that context. But if you're doing that, you make it for that medium, and you think of it in those terms. Look, it is what it is. This film is getting a theatrical release in the States, which I'm really pleased about. One of the biggest pluses of Netflix is that it goes out to a lot of people, and you don't have the strange opening weekend thing where you're wondering if anyone will turn up, and if they don't, it vanishes from cinema screens in 2 weeks. So it's got its plus and minuses, but from my viewpoint and the collective of the people who made it, it was made to be seen on a big screen.
It had to be.
Yeah, I mean, this is a cinematic film. Handmaid's Tale is not. And just the sound design and the visual aspects of this film... You'll only really experience the full thing and appreciate it in a 5.1 surround system.
Or even more so. But I want to go back to the Netflix thing, because I think what Netflix is introducing now, okay, and what the potential of happening is, particularly with Cloverfield Paradox, okay. Number one, throughout the year, there are what is called dumping grounds for distributing movies. They tend to be right after the holidays, so like going on right after New Year's, so January, February, and into early March, right? Everybody's back to work, back to school. They're not going to the movies as much, all right? There are a couple of movies that could come out to be sleeper hits, but for the most part, studios are putting their movies that they don't feel are going to be able to compete with summer movies, with the holiday movies, and then it happens right after Labor Day. So we're looking at end of August, right into beginning of September, and right into the beginning of October. They were traditionally known as dumping grounds, where they would put their weaker titles out to market, or out for the audiences, right? They would take a chance. Some movies did well, because they released good movies. Other movies, you never heard from them again. Okay, so they lost money. What Netflix is doing now, or appears to be doing, is taking that away. You pay a studio like Paramount $50 million for a movie like Cloverfield. You can... basically, that mitigates their P&A cost. Like, they don't have to worry about distributing a movie. They don't have to worry about the publicity of said movie, like taking people on tour to market the movie. They don't have to make posters. They don't have to make any in-theater marketing material. They're getting $50 million right up front. So if that movie costs $30 million, $40 million, they're making money, right? Netflix looks at it as, I'm getting a commodity. I'm getting a Cloverfield movie, or the guy that directed Ex Machina. I can get their movie. They can market it via Netflix, and they're going to get views in one way, shape, or form. And whatever the audience makeup is, if the audience doesn't like it, no big deal. They're already subscribing. They're not going to quit their subscription because they saw a shitty movie or television show on Netflix. At the movie, they'll get soured and maybe never go to a movie again. It's like, oh, I felt burned from that. I get it, and it is, in a sense, could be changing our distribution model. I, for one, am happy that this movie was released theatrically. Regardless of what I think of the movie, okay, this deserved to be... You can understand why a studio... The guy did Ex Machina, which was held to great esteem. Critics liked it. Audiences liked it. It had a good run. I think the biggest mistake that Paramount made is the way in which it was distributed. They did go wide, where I believe Ex Machina sort of kind of filtered out. They didn't mitigate anywhere. They went out 2,000 plus screens, which, let's be honest, 2,000 in this day and age, when you're going up against a Black Panther or a Star Wars movie, which is more than double what 2,000 is, right? But still, they have to market it. They have to get ads for it. They need people to talk about, you know, whether it be cast and the director. All that costs money. And when we're looking at, you know, when we look at this movie, the sad thing about it is that it really isn't making that much money at the box office. A C, as you mentioned, on CinemaScore does not help. That's for sure. It got an 87% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is good.
Pretty high.
That's very high.
Pretty high.
You know, with it, right?
For sci-fi, which people are brutal about sci-fi.
They can be very brutal about sci-fi, but a C score means there is going to be no word of mouth to support this movie. Also, you know, you have to throw in there is the unprecedented box office of Black Panther. Black Panther has been a juggernaut and a tidal wave. Right. It's the big thing that's sucking up all the water. It's sucking up all of the audience. Where,
well, now you're going to have two movies. Wrinkle in Time and Black Panther and it's Disney against Disney.
Yeah. And so that, too, was when you're looking at a release date, you think, oh, well, I'm coming out a couple of weeks after that. We know that Black Panther is going to open big, but will it be able to sustain? Nobody knew that it was going to sustain in such record-breaking fashion in its second, third week, right? So you're more or less, they got, it was a perfect storm for this movie not to do well. $40 million cost. Somebody's thinking, Jesus Christ, we could have gotten $50 million for this movie. You know, because it had a cast. But then you'd have people, I think once you go to Netflix, you already downgrade the quality and quantity of your product. You know, once I hear that Cloverfield is going to Netflix instead of it opening up on the big screen, I'm thinking, this movie's not that great. And when I just recently saw movies like Bright would never make it on the big screen. You understand why it's on Netflix. I mean, Netflix has better looking television shows. You know, and if you want to talk science fiction, like Altered Carbon, per se. But I would have felt bad for Garland and Company had they made the decision to go to Netflix. I mean, anytime you make a movie, it's a work of art. There's a sacrifice in making that movie, and there's always risk involved. You know, the test screening process. Maybe they could have amended things. I don't know. But they knew that they sort of kind of had a movie that was a stinkeroo. So, yeah, but you have to go through with it. And I think it's too good looking of a movie to just be on your...
Well, it would have been interesting because part of it was, okay, well, how do you change it up a little bit? And I think there could have been ways to change it up. I don't know.
Well, what are your thoughts? Would you have rather seen this on Netflix?
No, I think it was definitely worth seeing on a big screen. but I can't necessarily fault, especially, you know, you have to factor in, it's Paramount. They haven't had a hit in forever. So, yeah, they're acting from a place of, how do we just make money? Period.
Yeah. And I think Jim Giannopoulos is at a point where he's inherited all these projects, and he just wants them off his slate. He wants, because they aren't things that he oversaw, coming in. So I think that plays into it as well. But you can't take away that this is a theatrical movie.
Yeah, I just, like, I would not have enjoyed this film as much if I watched it on Netflix. Honestly. It is a movie made for theater.
It was.
Well, clearly. The movie hasn't come out yet internationally, so it'll be interesting to see reactions. And I'm curious, for fans that we have where outside of the U.S., I'm curious to know your reaction to the movie. Because you will, unfortunately, I mean, I don't know how, but you'll never have that experience unless by some miracle.
And that's where else they shot themselves in the foot, too, I believe, by selling off to Netflix. As we've proven on this show, there are times where the international release is making far more than the domestic release of that movie. And it's brought the gross, the worldwide gross, upwards and onwards to $100 million. Who wants to say no to that? And when you have somebody like Alex Garland, when you have somebody who's an international star like Natalie Portman, right? Like, why wouldn't you go for that? And who knows, maybe you get a higher percentage of box office internationally. That, I mean, everybody's touting worldwide gross today now. It's hard. Like, yes, we have our domestic gross. The top five is still
like,
possible.
I feel like the movies that do better internationally are usually the ones that center around a storyline that deals with international people.
Well,
so, like, worldwide type of... Like, Arrival did great internationally because so many countries were involved in that movie. And I feel just the story of Annihilation is like one little place in America.
Perhaps
it's not as international.
But science fiction always plays, I think, internationally. And then when you have movies like, I don't know, well, the Fast and Furious movies, those play huge overseas. A Stallone movie.
Morocco.
Yeah, but those stars are very big. And you're right. Arrival did $102 million overseas. It made over $100 million, $100.5 million domestically. So why not give it a shot? I don't know how they make their money internationally. And why do you have an international distribution department?
It's not going to do well.
I get where they're coming from. I'm not saying I agree with it. But in this sense, they have not had a surefire bet in forever. The last thing they need is another thing on their hands.
Yeah, you know what they did? They dumped it.
Well, they did. Again, The point is, I'm not going to sit here and argue against that.
Yeah.
From their perspective, but it is what it is.
It is what it is.
All right. Well, we can certainly talk about this movie far more. There's so much to dissect there, but... unfortunately, that's all we're going to give you today. But that's why we have the comments. You guys can rate. You guys can comment and let us know what you guys think. And it's been fun. In the meantime...
Letter grade. What do you give it? Quick. Letter grade.
B+.
Yeah, strong B+.
All right. I'm more like a C-.
All right.
Than that. But I'm curious what the audience thinks because it did get an 87%.
That's not the audience.
But that's a B+ from the critics. It's an 87% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Well, the audience gave it a C.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Interesting.
All right. In the meantime, where can people interact with you, Marissa?
Everyone can follow me everywhere at Serafini2.
Everywhere. Everywhere. I follow you everywhere. At DMovies1701.
Amazing. And follow me at Phil Svitek and check out my website, philsvitek.com, for more information. Dimitri, do you want to, speaking of international casts, since we have this platform, Brenda's thing, it's public, yeah?
It is public, yeah.
Do you want to give a little plug for that?
Well, sure, thank you. I've set up, I set up a memorial scholarship on behalf of my wife, who passed away from cancer in 2016. It's with an organization that she would have been fond of and she would have contributed to. It's called A Place Called Home, and they specifically have a program called Girl Power. And with Girl Power, it's there to incentivize, to inspire young girls from the ages of 8 all the way up through their going to college. So I set up a foundation under Brenda Rios Panos, the Brenda Rios Panos Foundation. If you go to a place called home.org, you can find places to donate for this. Know that it is really going for a good cause, and that I did it because my wife, albeit in another place, a better place, one without pain, she can continue to inspire. And the scholarship will go to a girl or girls who are entering their first year of college, and it'll help them on their way. This is something that I know would have been very, very important for my wife to do. She would have been a part of the program had we both known about this prior to her passing. So this is a way in which her name and legacy can continue to go on. So A Place Called Home.org, Girl Power, there are places where you could donate if you'd be so kind. When you do it, just put it in for the Brenda Rios Panos Foundation or scholarship program.
Yes, and so. Brenda's had been instrumental in inspiring in particular, Hispanic girls to get into the arts. And when you talk about inclusion, you get, you know, I mean, it's a great side of a voice, and you know, the effect of it won't be immediate, but in the coming years, hopefully, we'll be talking about some of their movies here on Anatomy.
Yeah, you know, you can only hope. And if you are in the LA area, I strongly urge you to maybe take a tour, see what this Girl Power is all about, because you do have the opportunity. These are kids with troubled backgrounds, and they are given a place called home, but they're given reason, they're given purpose, and they are really given something to inspire. It's meant to inspire young girls. And my wife, Brenda, was an inspiration. She had a troubled childhood, and she became president marketing for Pantaleone Films. She worked her way up through hard work and love and caring. So thank you very much. That's a shock. I appreciate you allowing me the time.
Of course.
Thank you. It's very kind.
Of course. So please go support. And thank you guys, as always, for supporting us and allowing us to continue doing what we do. With that scary noise, it's time for us to get out
that
of here.
That scary noise.
Talk to you guys later. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.